Okay, well, yes, it is 10 o'clock, and I did hear that we were going to have some folks join a little bit later, and they've alerted us of that. I did want to excuse the Lieutenant Governor. She was not able to attend today, so she's asked me to chair the meeting on her behalf, and we do have a packed agenda today. Thanks for everybody that has joined. I need to read up front this statement about the virtual meeting. So at this stage of the COVID-19 pandemic, conducting the meeting with an anchor location presents a risk to the health and safety of those who may be present at the anchor location. Therefore, only electronic access to the meeting will be available. So thank you, everybody, for joining virtually. We know it's great to get together in person, but we just thought with everybody feeling comfortable with the virtual meeting and with kind of some of the rising cases, it makes sense to meet virtually today. Just a couple of things before we get started on some of the presentations and the approval of minutes. Earlier this year, the commission increased in size to allow a new member under HB 56. And I don't see Nubia, but I think we've welcomed her in the past. She is with she's the director of the Multicultural Affairs and the Department of Heritage and Arts. She's also the governor's senior advisor on those issues. So if she is here joining, we just wanted to recognize Nubia as a member of the commission, but it doesn't look like she's had a chance to join us yet. So moving on, our last meeting was in April on the 14th, and we had a joint IGP Welfare Reform Commission and advisory board, just like we're having today. We distributed those meeting minutes, and so and they were also posted on the public notice website. So what I'd like to do at this time is call for a motion to approve those minutes. So do I have a motion to approve? And actually,
Casey,
I think we have a quorum.
Can we do a roll call? Yeah. I'm not sure we have a quorum yet.
My screen's finally populating everybody. So let's skip that. And let's go to Mary Beth. Why don't we go to, we'll come back to the approval of the minutes. Let's go to Mary Beth. Thank you, Mary Beth, for joining. We're going to talk about trauma-informed care, get an update from Mary Beth on that today. So looks like Mary Beth has joined, and we're happy to hear your presentation today, Mary Beth.
Good morning, everyone. I am actually not Mary Beth. I'm Sarah Shea, the project manager of TIU, and I am actually going to kick us off this morning. So thank you. Co-chair Cameron, is that correct? Members of the Intergenerational Welfare Reform Commission and the Intergenerational Poverty Committee for the opportunity to provide the update on the efforts of the Trauma-Informed Utah Initiative. So I already introduced myself, and Mary Beth Vogel-Ferguson is here as well. She is the former chair of the Resilient Utah Subcommittee, and she's going to share some background on the project, and then I'll step back in and provide a summary of the proposal for the Trauma-Informed Utah Center. So, Mary Beth, take it away.
Thanks, Sarah. Next slide, please. It really is amazing to realize that this effort started nearly 10 years ago with the passage of the Intergenerational Poverty Mitigation Act in 2012. Nearly 5 years into the effort, then Lieutenant Governor Cox initiated the Trauma Subcommittee, later renamed Resilient Utah, with the charge to make Utah a trauma-informed state. Clearly no small task. Next slide. After struggling for a couple of years to get traction, the committee, with the support of the Department of Health, conducted a statewide survey to learn more about what was already happening around trauma-informed efforts and to explore where agencies and organizations needed more resources and support. Responses came from nearly all of Utah's 29 counties. More than three-quarters of the respondents said they were interested in participating in future trauma-informed collaborations. Next slide. In August of 2019, after analyzing the data and exploring several options, Resilient Utah formally recommended the creation of a center to support the effort to make Utah a trauma-informed state. As minutes from the meetings note, Lieutenant Governor Cox called for a motion to support moving forward with the creation of a Center for Resilient Utah. After being moved and seconded, the motion carried unanimously. Next slide. In early 2020, more than 35 members of the community gathered to launch this effort. I think it was actually the last in-person event I attended before everything was shut down. The onset of the pandemic only increased the calls for help to support agencies and organizations whose staffs were overwhelmed when trying to manage family demands, the work's very hard jobs. In June of 2020, we met again to get the effort back on track. It was actually during this meeting that Tracy Gruber took steps to move the effort into the hands of the Department of Health, really where it belongs. This is more than a poverty issue. It impacts all of us. The effort needed funding if it was going to be sustained, as up to this point, the work had been unfunded. Next slide. With this shift came the hiring of project manager Sarah Shea and the launching of the Trauma-Informed Utah Initiative. Sarah has a strong background in guiding community collaborative efforts and has lived in both rural and urban parts of our state. She's really been a powerful leader. Next slide. To inform the effort, Sarah, along with the executive committee, developed three planning committees. The center development committee focused on designing the center structure, including the type of entity it would be, where it should be housed, budget decisions, etc. The scope committee focused on the work of the center, who it should serve and what areas, making sure that it would be a statewide effort. And the research committee focused on how the center could both use and create data to ensure the effort remained accountable to the community and could produce findings that would inform others trying to move in the same direction. Next slide. I'm sure it's hard to read, but we wanted to acknowledge the work of our 80-plus community partners from diverse communities, multiple sectors, and all across the state. Their energy really drove the effort. So why did we do it? Next slide. For me personally, it is the faces behind the DWS data we've collected over the years, showing the high prevalence of childhood adversity in our low-income adults. Childhood trauma is strongly associated with challenges keeping a job, engaging in healthy relationship, and other activities of adult learning. And as this committee knows well, those challenges often get passed down to the next generation. Next slide. While we know Utahns are strong and resilient, we also have evidence of struggle. We lose too many people to suicide and opioid misuse. The human and economic costs of trauma are high. Our systems can sometimes contribute to the problem, and our service providers want to help in doing what they do better. Next slide, please. The data shows that the correlation between childhood trauma and later use of the expensive public services like emergency rooms, the justice system, the child welfare system are really high. And over the years, efforts by various parts of our state government have tried to address these issues. Next slide. After extensive work with the committees and a review of local and national efforts, the trauma-informed approach, as developed by SAMHSA, has really surfaced as the best framework for moving Utah toward becoming a trauma-informed state. In this framework, realizing is really about learning about the impact of trauma in children and adults, and this is an important and the potential paths of recovery or prevention. It's about building community resilience through focusing on things like social determinants of health, social and emotional learning, building social capital, and positive childhood experiences. With this knowledge, we can then recognize the signs of trauma and respond in ways that help and don't hurt, all in an effort to resist re-traumatization. Next. The COVID pandemic has impacted us all. For vulnerable populations, the long-term mental and physical health consequences are just starting to appear. The trauma-informed approach is going to be an even more important framework for our agencies and organizations as we all try to move forward. Next slide. It involves taking these six principles of the trauma-informed approach: safety, empowerment, culture, all of these pieces, and, next slide, applying them to all aspects of our organizations, from policy and physical environment to leadership and evaluation. Next slide. And ultimately, it is the integration of the trauma-informed approach into the life of agencies and organizations that will be the work, the primary work of the Trauma-Informed Utah Center. Next slide. And Sarah's going to fill us in on the details.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Mary Beth, for the background. So now let's look forward and dive into the details of this TIU Center. Okay, next slide. Before we get into the specifics, we wanted to highlight the four themes or purposes that surface throughout the center development process. So as opposed to the center coming in with all these answers, Trauma-Informed Utah will be responsive to needs named by the organization, which allows them to take the lead in creating solutions that work best for their specific entity. This approach also ensures sustainability of the work of the center over time. Another purpose is to strengthen connections between agencies and sectors across Utah who are already doing this work. Feedback from both the Resilient Utah Survey and the TIU committee members indicated that many organizations feel that they're kind of going at it alone, when the reality is that there are numerous organizations, even within the same community, who are working on becoming trauma-informed. The TIU committee wants the center to help break down these silos. Additionally, given these existing efforts, the center will focus on reducing duplication of effort, so bringing heads together instead of working alone to reinvent this trauma-informed wheel. This approach increases efficiency and effectiveness of TIU resources. Lastly, the expertise of the center is intended to support all of these existing efforts rather than replace those efforts. So one way I kind of picture this is thinking of the center as like a turbo charge for your engine, kind of rather than ordering a whole new engine for your car. So most importantly, one learning piece that we took away from this process was that TIU will not provide trauma treatment or therapy. Instead, the center might partner with a direct service agency to develop trauma-informed policies and practices that would help the organization be trauma-informed as a whole. Next slide. Okay. So because the trauma-informed framework is an approach rather than a sector-specific program, the center can provide support to any type of business or agency. While the trauma-informed approach originated as a framework for mental health agencies, there's a rapidly growing need for this support across all types of sectors in our community. As Mary Beth said earlier, COVID really illuminated this reality. For example, we brainstormed ideas with private sector partners around addressing stress and burnout in industries like construction and hospitality. Next slide. And the center will serve these various community sectors across all corners of our state. So from frontier to rural to urban communities. And the center will rely heavily on the website as well as these local community networking chapters to maximize access to services, regardless of your zip code. Next slide. Okay, so we've reviewed the reach of the center, but what do we actually mean when we say the center? The Center Development Committee spent significant time thinking about the structure of the center. They considered numerous options, including being housed within a state agency, embedded within a higher education institution, or joining an existing 501c3. And ultimately, they decided that a public-private partnership administered by a standalone 501c3 would be the best mechanism to maximize accessibility both for financial contributors and those using center services. And we recognize that while the public-private partnership is a widely accepted model for large infrastructure projects like an airport, it's less conventional for these smaller types of projects. Yet the development committee felt that this model is the best way to accomplish the center's goals. So first, as an independent organization, 100% of center resources will be focused on the mission of making Utah a trauma-informed state, instead of also having to support the mission of a parent organization. Next, this model will allow the center to weather the inherent ebbs and flows that often occur in both state and nonprofit agencies. And lastly, a 501c3 increases diversification of funding streams and ensures financial benefits for both private funders and serving as a well-established pathway for state agency contributions. Next slide. So given the careful thought put into the structure of the organization, the development committee was equally thoughtful in outlining the funding structure of the center. So first and foremost, the committee wanted the center's funding streams to reflect the sectors that will benefit from center services. So meaning funding will reflect financial buy-in from both public and private partners. And because this effort was initiated at the state level by this committee, the Center Development Committee felt that the state should be the primary funder of the center's initial startup period. However, because the center will serve both public and private sectors, they expected and expect the private sector to equally contribute to the center over time. Next slide. Okay, so we've covered logistics of the center, and now we get to dive into the fun stuff. What will the center actually do for our community? So as Mary Beth mentioned, we brought together a center scope committee, our what I call the boots on the ground professionals, to provide perspectives on designing these center services. So what started out as a lot of brainstorming was categorized down into four main areas: education, community networking, technical assistance, and research, all of which will be free and openly accessible to our community. The TIU Center proposal outlines these areas in more detail, which you can review at your leisure. But with time in mind today, we'll only touch on one example from each area. Okay, so next slide. So one of the main education services of the center will be a trauma-informed champions academy. The center will offer an introductory course on trauma, the trauma-informed framework, and the basics of customizing trauma-informed approaches to a specific agency. So remember, the trauma-informed approach is a framework, not a program. So this champions academy was imagined with the teach a man or woman to fish kind of concept and approach in mind. So participants will go back and serve as the trauma-informed point person for their organization and have the TIU Center as a supportive research resource in the background. Okay, next slide. Okay, so in addition to education, one of the other highly requested services from our committee was peer networking. So this service will facilitate idea sharing and give smaller, more rural communities local control in shaping trauma-informed practices that fit their unique needs. So the idea is to work with local partners to identify the best way to establish a chapter, whether that's partnering with an existing coalition or maybe something new. And so to me, when we say the center is a statewide resource, this is really the heart of that mission. I love the idea and concept that each community will figure out what works best for their needs. Next slide. Okay, so continuing with the theme of idea sharing, the scope committee also saw networking as a key part of technical assistance. Many of our partners, especially, again, in these rural communities, want to collaborate with those doing the same type of work. So, for example, partners working in early education across the state could access a technical assistance work group to troubleshoot specific needs that they may not be able to meet in or through their local trauma-informed community chapter. Next slide. Okay, and last but not least, we have research. So research will be important to TIU for many reasons, but one main driving factor is that Utah already has numerous researchers working in the fields of ACEs, trauma, resilience, trauma-informed care, and so forth. So we formed a research subcommittee to give recommendations on the development of the center. And in fact, I think he's in attendance. One of our research partners, Ben Gibbs, is on this IGP committee. The committee was adamant, the Center Development Committee, was adamant that evidence-based practices would drive the work of the center, and the research subcommittee will help deliver on this commitment. Okay, next slide. Okay, so as Mary Beth shared, we wrapped up the center planning process in June. And since then, we've continued to kind of get the center ready to launch with the help of our TIU task force. So one important step included submitting a 501c3 application to the IRS, as the current approval timeline is pending 18 months at the moment. We also continue to share the center proposal with stakeholders to gather feedback. So earlier this month, we presented to the directors of the state Children's Justice Centers, and then we turned around and presented at the Utah Domestic Violence Coalition. And although the center doesn't exist, we still continue to receive weekly requests for the type of support that one day will be provided by the center. And one of our biggest goals was to reconnect with this group. The committee who approved that original trauma center concept back in August of 2019. And while our timeline was impacted by a few unanticipated pandemic complications, we're really excited to be back with you to share the proposal for the TIU Center. So thank you. Next slide. Okay, so wrapped up presentation, and now I think we can open discussion with a few of these questions to the group. So questions to consider. Does this group, do you support Utah in becoming a more trauma-informed state? Do you support the idea of moving forward with the development of the Trauma-Informed Utah Center? And what suggestions do you have regarding the most effective ways to move this effort forward? Awesome. And with that, thank you. We can open it up for questions.
Okay, thank you, Sarah and Mary Beth. That was great. We appreciate you coming to present. Are there any questions for Sarah or Mary Beth?
Looks like Roy has his hand up, and then Councilman Winder.
Okay. Do we call? So just, Roy, go for it.
Okay, yeah. Yeah, I go by Neil Davis. That's okay.
Oh.
First name's right.
So sorry.
What? Good? Fine. So this is really great work, and I love how you've divided it up into different service areas. So thank you for all your work on this. Exciting to see where this has come. I am very curious what your thoughts are on measuring success over time. What is that going to look like, and how would you measure it? And that's what I'm curious about.
Yeah, that is a great question. You know, we actually spent quite some time talking about this throughout the center development process, especially in our research subcommittee. You know, one thing that we've really kind of thought a lot about is the idea that the trauma-informed approach is this framework, right? And you don't traditionally measure the impact of a framework, right? You measure specific impacts of interventions within the framework itself. And so, you know, I think the center can have outputs regarding number of organizations that are served, number of partners that engage with center services, number of community chapters that are established. So those are some kind of just engagement type metrics. And then I think when organizations themselves start to get into this work, the center will be able to help those organizations track their own outcomes related to kind of that crosswalk, right? So you've got the principles and then the domains. And so, for instance, if an organization says, hey, we're going to overhaul our intake process, and we're going to do a little, we're going to do a pre and post around kind of that specific trauma-informed intervention, the center can help an organization create some sort of metric to kind of track that change. But of course, that's not the center doing the work, right? That's the organization. And so I think we'll use proxy measures like that to also be able to track the input at the center. Does that answer your question?
Yes, thank you. I think that makes sense. I think even things like member of organization something might be useful, like you talked about. But yes, thank you, Sarah.
Yeah. And that's certainly why we have the research subcommittee on board to help answer some of these questions. Okay, so we have another question from Councilwoman Newton.
Hi.
Hey, good to see you.
Thank you, Mary Beth and Sarah, for this presentation. I'm very interested in this. I truly believe that we are not going to be able to figure out how to break the cycle of intergenerational poverty until we tackle this piece. And so I'm really excited that you guys have moved this forward in the way that you have. So to answer your questions that you have here, do I support Utah becoming a more trauma-informed state? Absolutely. And I also support the idea of moving forward with the development of this trauma-informed center. I do have some questions for you on, you had mentioned that you're getting weekly requests from different organizations of things that they would like help with. Can you give us some ideas of some examples there?
Sure. I would say the biggest request that comes in is training. People see kind of, especially those who have like frontline workers. So for instance, one specific example was very early on in the pandemic, we received a call from a domestic violence group who has a team of caseworkers. And she was saying, our caseworkers are now working at home. They are doing this work in their own space. There's not as much separation between the work, you know, and their own personal lives. And they're experiencing burnout and secondary traumatic stress. And we need you to come in and help us brainstorm how do we support our team with this transition. So that's one example. We recently received a request last week from an organization who was looking at, asked for review of their policies and procedures, wanting to be able to integrate some trauma-informed principles into their policies. So that email came in on Friday. So, the need is there.
Well, I think this would be helpful. I mean, from a healthcare provider perspective, super helpful for them to understand how to deal with patients that are dealing with childhood trauma. I also think as we look at ways that we can get people back into the workforce, I feel like that this is a key piece for businesses, for DWS to understand, for us as counties to understand how to be more helpful in this arena. And so I really think this is critical. So I really appreciate all the work that you're doing, and I hope our state decides to continue forward with supporting your efforts. So thank you.
Yeah, thanks for your comments. Any other questions?
I just had a thought real quick.
Yeah.
From my perspective, I feel like the topic of trauma is somewhat taboo and difficult for organizations and people to manage those discussions. Mm-hmm. Talking about adverse childhood experiences can be done poorly.
Sure.
And I think it's important to note that a trauma-informed approach addresses something that's really difficult to talk about, but is critical to talk about. And it makes sense to me that a lot of organizations really struggle to effectively connect with individuals in this way. And I think that deserves some mention as this group considers of IGP and breaking the cycle of poverty, that this is an approach that can really, I think, effectively address something that otherwise is really riddled with error and could be potentially harmful if not done appropriately for certain populations. And I'm curious if that's something you've thought about as you engage with other agencies or groups, that kind of taboo element of this question about trauma.
Oh, yeah. I think that when we go back to basics and think about how to institute change and help organizations grow and evolve, education and kind of level setting with terminology and being able to kind of address a really hard topic is the first place to start. So when we think about kind of the educational opportunities that the center could engage in, I think that's kind of square one. Both within an organization and in the greater community. And that's where I think some of that partnership comes into play because, you know, for instance, the Department of Health is engaging with community partners around this idea of educating on ACEs and trauma and resilience at this moment. So we know that those efforts are underway, but they definitely could be well-informed with a trauma-informed approach.
Looks like we have another hand raised. Jennifer Mitchell?
Sure. Thanks, Rebecca and Mary Beth. I just want to kind of add to what Dr. Benjamin Gibbs was acknowledging. I think when we think back to the original ACEs research and the population and the frequency with which that population of, you know, mostly middle-class individuals was experiencing that adversity, and then we extrapolate and think about what that means with the workforce that is providing services to individuals and layering in that to talk about trauma with a workforce that doesn't get support in managing their own trauma and experiences and how that's playing out in the day-to-day work, I think it is a recipe for things to feel not just harder, but re-traumatizing in a lot of ways. And so I think the fact that there is this effort, and so grateful that this is being moved forward to support organizations who are, you know, trying to manage bottom lines, trying to get all of the services out there to the families and children that are needing it, that ultimately there does need to be this kind of home base that is holding up best practice and how to engage in these conversations, holding the needs of the employees and how this can play out in organizations. I think that's a critical component. So thank you for acknowledging that need.
Yeah. Trauma-informed care isn't just about the people you're serving, but it's about the people who are providing the services too. We definitely heard that a lot. So I see a comment in the chat. There was a day when the commission would provide support to legislation that addressed IGT. Is this still an approach the commission might take on a potential bill seeking funds for TIU?
That's more a question for the commission.
Yeah.
I really don't know kind of where we are as a commission executive, but it seems like some kind of potential sanctioning of this approach would be helpful if a bill is being considered or some other funding strategy. That's out of my lane, so it looks like Casey has to respond.
Thanks, Ben. Actually, all of the commission members have participated and given feedback to the Trauma Informed Utah Center as well as the governor's office, and we have come up with funding within our own agencies that we could use to support this. I think some of the feedback we have received, though, is that maybe you're looking for general fund funding, and some of our funding streams may or may not work. But both Tracy, myself, our staff, and the governor's office have reviewed this and are very supportive. One of the things that, you know, just in terms of the budget process and this commission, we've never necessarily sponsored a bill or legislation, although we have reviewed and had people bring things to us. And so I just wanted to kind of remind folks of that process. So certainly I think that, you know, having vetted it here and having the support of the commission and the committee members and having the governor's office support it is good, but we don't necessarily sponsor or run legislation. And so we would leave that up to the Trauma-Informed Utah Center to, you know, work that through the normal legislative process. And then if the legislature does give general fund money, it could come through, you know, one of our agencies, just depending on how that made sense, if it went through human services or health or workforce services or however that worked. But we do have some internal funding if that remains an option, and we have vetted this it thoroughly with Mary Beth, but we wanted to make sure it came before the committee and the commission if there were other ideas from you all. So that's just kind of from the governor's office perspective and our department. I wish Tracy was here or Nate Checkets, but I'll just kind of speak on their behalf for what we have done. And Mary Beth, I don't know if you want to add to that or Sarah, but I think there's been a lot of good communication and interest from the governor's office on this as well.
Our direction from the governor's office was to bring it back to this commission and committee, so we were really just thrilled to be able to do that and would look forward to future conversations so that we can all work in the same lane, working moving forward together. That's great news to hear.
Casey, would it be appropriate for our group to make a motion to continue to support this, or do you need anything like that for us to be able to continue?
I think we can. The reason why we haven't taken, why we haven't sponsored specific legislation in the past is because we have so many different cabinet members on here, and so we kind of wait to see what ends up in the governor's budget, and that's kind of our marching orders is to support the governor's budget. So it's just a weird spot that we end up in as commission members. And in the past, we've had legislation that's come before us that isn't in the governor's budget, right? And so that's just been the approach of the commission is we can always, you know, offer our support and, you know, everything that we've talked about here, having this group certainly support it. It started here, as Mary Beth mentioned. I'm just a little unclear how the funding is moving forward. Is it moving forward as a nonprofit? Is it going to be moving forward? I've heard maybe as part of a hospital group. Is it moving forward? Is the idea to move it forward in terms of being a part of an agency? And I think those are all things that I'm just wondering, you know, those are the kinds of things that I would want to talk about because it really makes a difference in terms of how funding gets allocated. So maybe just a little bit more about how you're planning to move the center forward and if it's going to be embedded in an agency or as part of the U of U hospital, or is it going to be standalone and those types of things.
I can answer that. I think that, I mean, the idea is to have it function as that standalone 501c3. I mean, the Center Development Committee spent several meetings discussing different options, and I think that idea of that public-private partnership where those private funders can come in and provide support in addition to public funders through that independent 501c3 felt like the best way for the organization to move forward, both with being efficient with financial resources, as well as kind of maximizing the benefits for potential funding coming from those private funders who may look for some sort of, tax-exempt kind of part of their funding contribution.
There's been conversations as well as having maybe kind of dual leadership in the sense of the board of the 501c3 would be looking at the running of the activities, but perhaps there could be a state partnership, a committee that would work with the board in, especially initially as the bulk of the funding was state-centered,
to make sure that the needs of the state agencies and those organizations were being met, and that the direction and accountability around the deep research and the data could also be provided back relative to those funds. So I think there's some opportunities for conversation around what the management of the organization might look like as well, given that it isn't independent. It's not housed anywhere. It just has this mission that Sarah described.
So will you be, just trying to think forward to like the legislative session and your budget request, will you be requesting general fund money, lobbying for that appropriation, or how do you see that moving forward?
Well, I guess honestly that's what question three is, because our task was to produce a proposal and a budget, and we've done that. And so we were really looking to the leadership of the commission and the committee to be able to say, what suggestions do you have on what pathway you would like us to follow to seek that funding? And so we're open to suggestions on any of those aspects.
Can I make a suggestion? It sounds like you guys are going to be able to get some funding to get you through until next year, till we can obtain some funds from the legislature. Is that, am I understanding that correctly, Casey, that the different entities or the different agencies are going to be able to help continue to fund this, the progress on this in the short run? It's figuring out the long-term funding solution. Is that, am I understanding that correctly?
I don't know. We've offered up some funding, but I don't know if it works for the makeup of how they're, the activities. So, for instance, like in our department, we have some very specific funding, and I'm not sure if you guys have talked to Health and Human Services, I think, on that, too. So I think that would be a question for probably Sarah and Mary Beth, if that funding works for them or not.
I think the challenge right now is that the center doesn't exist, right? So we don't have staff, you know, just general staff people to do, you know, general activities. And so I think the idea of funding, I mean, I've been sitting here having worked in the nonprofit world saying, no, your funding isn't right for us, is like hearsay, right? But I think the idea to receive funding that is tied to really specific types of outcomes, working in very specific sectors, isn't really in alignment with kind of what the project needs right now, which is just kind of that startup like money to say, hey, we need to be able to hire staff people who could actually do activities and be able to kind of start the Trauma-Informed Champions Academy and build up these specific kind of activities within the four service areas. So I guess to answer your question, I think general funds would allow for us to kind of create that base that would then provide capacity and allow for capacity to kind of meet those more specific programmatic needs, if that makes sense.
So what I would suggest, and I don't know if this is even doable, but if you've got agencies who are willing to give funds for specific things, you know, whether it's hiring a staffer to do X, Y, Z, or whatever, like if that works, like in the short term, let's get through the next 9 months or whatever until the legislative session funds potentially kick in. What I would say is I don't see a reason why this group would not be able to support legislation and an appropriation to be able to fund this, because I mean, I know other state commissions that I'm involved with, we do that all the time. I'm involved in the Crisis Response Commission for Behavioral Health, and we have legislators that are in that group with us who are running legislation that our group is supporting. So, I mean, I would love to get a legislator who believes in this and can start going through that process. And I know, Casey, that puts you guys in a weird spot because you're working for the governor's office, and you know, we have the same thing with the Behavioral Health Commission I'm on too, where we have people on there that are working in the governor's office. But I think we've got to. If we're going to make something happen for the legislative session, we need to act now. And so I would love to see this group support moving forward with looking at legislation that could help figure out a way to fund this, at least for the next few years as they get off the ground, until some of those private dollars can start kicking in. So that would be my recommendation, is you guys cobble together a way to take agency funds to help you know, do specific things that meet the criteria that they would need to meet in order to give you the funding. And for long term, let's get some legislation going, and I'm very supportive and happy to talk to some legislators too to see who would be interested in running something like this.
Amy, knowing that we don't have I don't know if we have a quorum today, I think that would be appropriate coming from the committee, and I think that maybe sponsoring something or championing something or advocating, I think coming from the IGP committee, that would be completely appropriate because, you know, you guys all act in your own capacities and entities, and, you know, we don't yet have a quorum anyway. So if we were going to vote on something today, it would be much easier for the committee to vote on that and to provide that support. And so I would be in favor of that. And then just the other thing I think, and maybe this is more something we want to take offline so we can get to the reports, but I do think that, you know, it's a big ask to, you know, Sarah, you said that the trauma-informed center doesn't yet exist. And so when you're looking at funding, just my experience sitting up at the legislature, seeing this, you know, these requests come, when you're looking at funding something, it does need to exist. The 501c3 does need to exist. You need to have good controls in place. You need to have good financials in place, you know, attorneys, all those things. And I'm not a nonprofit expert, and so I'm not trying to come across as that. But that's just what I think is the difficult thing with this center. And I'm wondering if, I like Mary Beth's proposal that you have a board or you have some oversight, or that, you know, maybe we incubate it in a state agency initially and use some of this funding to start talking about the governance structure of a trauma-informed center, and then we can roll it out to an oversight of a board. I just wonder how feasible it is to get it up and running if you don't have a lot of seed money, if you don't have a lot of that general fund money, and would it make more sense to embed it and incubate it in an agency and then roll it out? Just as an idea, or, you know, incubate it somewhere that has that backbone infrastructure that could help you stand it up and then roll it out to, you know, a nonprofit and give you some time to get things in place. So that's another idea, too. And that was something that I think Tracy's on as a guest, but something that Tracy and I had kind of talked about, but we haven't really been able to connect with you guys on.
Yeah.
If that's something that you'd be interested in.
Yeah. I mean, I think at this point, we're just really interested in brainstorming these exact type of options. And I guess I want to clarify, when I say the center doesn't exist, I mean, I think the proposal is really, it's a blueprint for what the center will do, the staffing that's needed, we have a very detailed budget. When we submitted the 501c3 application, you have to have a TIU board and bylaws and articles of incorporation, and we have incorporated with the state in order to submit that application. So I think, like, we have all of these different pieces kind of in motion, but, you know, like, I'm the only paid person on this project, and I'm, you know, we get emails constantly saying, hey, can you, like, come out and do this or do this presentation? And I'm like, I'm only one person. I can only be so many places at once. So I think that that's more where we say, when the center doesn't exist, we just don't have, like, the personnel capacity to be able to meet the need. And I mean, I think if we could take it offline and say, sure, like, is incubating within a state agency the best way to move forward? I'd love to hear thoughts on that. Given, like, what the proposal is and kind of if that can fit, you know, streamline into a state agency, sure. I think that's exactly why we're here, is to hear feedback on those thoughts.
Okay, so do we want to take a motion, and it could be from the committee members, because it looks like we have plenty of the committee members on. And back to Amy's point here, do we want to take a motion to move this forward as a, you know, we could have a letter come from the advisory committee in support of this work so that you have a supportive letter. We could do something like that if that's what everybody wants to agree to, and then we could also just take this kind of offline and see how we can support you and the work that you're doing, especially with the funding that we've set aside that could maybe help seed this from some of our agencies and see if that provides a more robust structure for at least the first year or so until you can, kind of get some legislative support. It sounds like you have lots of folks here to champion some of that. Is that what I'm hearing we want to do? Is pull together a letter from the IGP committee?
I think that would be great, just so that we are on record saying that we're continuing to support this and we'd like to see some solutions, and I have to make a motion to that effect.
Okay, great. So we have a motion for a letter coming from the IGP Advisory Committee to support Trauma-Informed Utah, and their move forward to seek funding from the legislature as a 501c3 or other organization if we decide to move them into an embedded agency and incubate them there. I know it's a long motion, but do I have a second to that motion?
I would second that.
Okay. Is that Bill or Ben Gibbs?
We'll give it to Bill.
Okay. We'll give it to Bill. Okay. Second from Bill. Okay. All in favor of that motion? Please say yes or aye.
Aye.
Aye. Okay. All right. Well, that motion passes then, and we will thank you so much. That was a good discussion. I think that was a needed discussion. And then, Rebecca, if you'll just note then that we'll prepare that letter for Trauma-Informed Utah, and then we'll follow up with a meeting with the other state agencies and get back with Trauma-Informed Utah to see how we can support you. So
great.
Thank you for all your hard work to
get
this kind of sorted out and thought through, and just know that you have our support. We appreciate all that you're doing.
Casey, before we move on, there was one comment I just want to make sure gets heard. It was from Neil Davis. It said, a few comments have highlighted the possible positive impact to employees and businesses for becoming trauma-informed. It would be very interesting to see if the research team could evaluate that. Does empowering a business to be trauma-informed improve business outcomes? Is there an economic argument there? Just a thought. Thanks. I just want to make sure that comment got mentioned.
No, I mean, that is exactly why the research committee is in place, and one of the staff members outlined in the proposal for the center will be a PhD researcher, because there are many questions like this to be answered. So, thanks for Rebecca for pointing that out. Well, thank you so much, everyone, for supporting this work and for listening to our presentation, and we really look forward to hearing next steps and working with you to move this forward. So thank you.
Great. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much.
Montana Tracy Gruber has joined as a guest and was wondering if she could be elevated as a panelist because she had some comments.
I'm just looking at attendees now. Casey, is
she on the phone? She
is. Okay.
There we go. Tracy, is that you?
Hi there. Can you hear me now?
We can. Thanks, Tracy, for joining.
I'm sorry about that. No, and I'm sorry. I was being on the phone. It logged me in as a guest. I just had a couple of comments that I wanted to make, and I know you already took the motion, and that's great, and I think it's the right direction. First, again, thanks for all the hard work. As Casey said, this has been many years in the making. And I do support the idea of this having be incubated or contemplating incubating it in a state agency. And the Department of Health has been very supportive of this all along and has provided some funding so that this can continue to move forward. So I know the discussions that we've had about funding in the past and being able to leverage applications that we're applying for can help support that. And I think the one thing that I would say is that I do think for right now getting one-time, you know, focusing on one-time funds to get it established is the right approach rather than asking for ongoing at this point. It feels a little bit early for ongoing funding while we're still trying to get it off the ground. So that was just all I wanted to add. And I'll be on my computer in about 5 minutes.
Thank you, Tracy, for all your support and guidance over the years.
Yeah, no, I second that to Mary Beth, and I think I like the idea of one-time funding to kind of allow the center to kind of prove its worth, right? It makes sense.
Great. Thank you, everyone. Thanks, Tracy, for those comments. I think we'll move along now to kind of the meat of this meeting, which we've been looking forward to from our key researcher on IGP, Brittany Johnston. We have a great opportunity today to hear from her as well as our IGP research subcommittee. If you read the report this year, there's some great takeaways. Brittany did a good job kind of summarizing the top 10 findings. And then I've also read our DWS report from our researchers. I haven't read the other reports yet, but I'm looking forward to hearing their presentation from each of the committees. So, Brittany, we're excited to hear about the findings of this year's report. This is Brittany's first report, of course, taking over for the infamous Tracy Gruber, who previously was in charge of the data report. And just so everybody knows, on the call today, the IGP annual report will actually be released today. And so you're kind of hearing it live, and then we'll go out on some social media channels. This will be emailed to the legislature in accordance with the IGP legislation that's out there. So feel free to share, look on social media, and kind of promote this. We're excited for some of the data. It does include some findings from COVID and the impact there. So with that kind of set up, Brittany, the time is yours.
Thanks, Casey. Hi, everyone. Thanks for having me today. I'll be going over the 2021 IGP annual report. Like Casey said, this report showcases how many people are experiencing intergenerational poverty or IGP in Utah, their demographics, and where they live in the state. We also look at how they are doing in different areas of child well-being and how COVID-19 impacted them in 2020. So next slide. So first, to better understand the cycle of poverty, we must first understand poverty in general and the opportunity that's available here in Utah. Utah actually has one of the lowest poverty rates in the country, which you'll see on the next slide. But it's also known as one of the best places to live in the U.S. for upward mobility, specifically in the Salt Lake City metro area. It also ranked fourth for child well-being by the Kids Count data book, which is up from the 11th spot when Utah was ranked in 2012 when the IGP initiative first started. So we've seen great improvements over the years. And overall, Utah is in the best position to help individuals escape poverty and climb the economic ladder. Compared to some other states who may have other issues that they are trying to resolve first, or they don't have the time and resources to focus on poverty issues. Next slide. So this graph shows the poverty rate for U.S. children at the top green line. The middle pink line is Utah children, which is noticeably lower than the national average. We also have Utah's overall poverty rate, which includes adults, at the bottom. So in 2020, 8.9% of Utah adults were living in poverty and 9.9% of children. You'll see from 2012 to 2020, we have seen a drop over time for all the groups. So we are lower than the national average, and it has decreased over time. So you might ask, you know, why should we care about poverty issues in Utah if we're doing pretty well? Well, even though we have a low rate, it still means 1 in 10 Utahns are experiencing poverty. That 1 in 10 could be your neighbor, could be your friend, it could be your family member. So poverty is an issue that affects people we know, and it means that not all Utahns are reaching their full potential. Next slide. So let's explore how Utah defines poverty. We look at it through two different groups. One is situational poverty, and this is temporary. That's usually caused by an event, such as divorce, job loss, or death of a family member. In Utah, IGP is defined as multiple generations of participation in any one of the following public assistance programs. So we include SNAP, which is food assistance, Medicaid and CHIP, child care subsidies, and financial assistance through TANF. Over the years of doing this report, we have found a general trend that both groups of IGP and situational poverty, they both experience more adverse outcomes than the general population. But almost always, the IGP group has even worse rates when looking at different data indicators than the situational poverty group. So they both have more negative outcomes than the general population, but there is a difference between someone who is experiencing situational versus intergenerational poverty. We have also found that IGP is experienced by all types of people of all ages and is found throughout the state, which I'll go into more later on. Next slide, please. So like I said, we define IGP by public assistance. So we looked at what portion of our participants are experiencing IGP. We found that 29% of adults who are public assistance participants were IGP adults in 2020. And this is the same rate as 2019, so no change there. We found that 24% of children who are public assistance participants were IGP children, and this is a slightly higher rate than we saw in 2019. Next slide. We then looked into the IGP groups and asked what specific programs are they participating in. So in this graph, you'll see the green is 2019, red is 2020 for comparison. IGP adults on the left, IGP children on the right. Medicaid and SNAP by far are the most common programs. You'll see the only one that has changed over time or since 2019 is Medicaid for adults, so 82 to 86%. This is partially because Medicaid eligibility changed in 2020. It was extended federally due to COVID-19, so a person could stay on longer, even if there was an increase in their income. A large part of this increase, though, is because of Medicaid expansion, which started in 2020. Nearly 17,000 IGP adults enrolled in that program, most who probably didn't qualify before because they were in a coverage gap. So we believe that's where most of this increase is coming from. Next slide. All right, so how many Utahns are experiencing intergenerational poverty? We found nearly 49,000 IGP adults and just over 56,000 IGP children in 2020. And this accounts for 4% of all Utah adults and 6% of all Utah children. And you'll see here I put the criteria we use to determine IGP. This goes into more detail in the report, but essentially for adults, they have had 12 months of public assistance as a child and 12 months of assistance at any time as an adult here in Utah, and then also had at least 1 month reported in 2020. For IGP children, their parent belongs to the IGP adult cohort, and they also reported at least 1 month of public assistance in 2020. Next slide. All right, so where do Utahns experiencing intergenerational poverty live? So we looked at IGP by zip code to help localize where IGP adults and children lived. And here we're looking at just the counts. So we found that Ogden had zip codes with the highest counts of IGP for both adults and children. Other zip codes with high counts of IGP included West Valley City, Clearfield, Tooele, Vernal, Rose Park and Fair Park area in Salt Lake, and Kearns in Taylorsville. Next slide. So that was for IGP. Our report also looks at who is at risk of remaining in poverty as adults. This, of course, includes IGP children. They already have an IGP parent, and their families are already in a cycle of poverty. But we also include a second group of kids when calculating this rate. So this includes children who receive public assistance for at least 12 months at any time as a child. And this is because they are already starting to fulfill half of the definition of an IGP adult, and they may be on their way to starting their family's cycle of poverty. So with that, for 2020, we had 21% of Utah children who were at risk of remaining in poverty as adults. This is actually the same as 2019, so no change here. Next slide. Okay, so we took that at-risk rate and broke it down by county. This is the measure that follows what has traditionally been done in the past when looking at location for the at-risk rate. So here you can see the darker pink have higher rates of children at risk remaining in poverty. This is the percent of the county's child population who are considered at risk. So you'll see San Juan County is the highest on the bottom right corner at 52% of their child population who are experiencing IGP. Paiute is also high at 43%. The lowest counties are Morgan at 8% and Summit County at 10%. Next slide. And also you'll see all these graphs in the report and all this information there if you're looking to look back at this later. All right, so let's dive into the demographics of our IGP population. By gender, 62% of IGP adults were women, which made up the majority of IGP adults. The reason for this could be because a woman's household income may be low, causing them to be in poverty. Say if they are a single working woman, they're the sole provider of their family and they don't have two incomes, like a two-parent household. Or maybe she is unable to work full-time because of her full-time responsibility as a parent. I'll go into employment by gender a little on. That dives into this a little bit more. In our report, we look at what other national studies or reports say about poverty reduction for certain groups of people. For women, we found it's common knowledge that women earn less than men here in Utah. And the Institute for Women's Policy Research, just this year, they found that narrowing the wage gap would help with poverty reduction. They predicted that poverty would be reduced through equal pay. For Utah working women, they'd go from 8.5% to 5.4%, and Utah working single mothers, 25.2% to 15.1%. And this research, they were looking at women who were receiving equal pay with comparable men of the same age, same education level, same working hours, and the same urban-rural status. Next slide. Okay, by race, we found that American Indians have the highest rates of experiencing IGP out of all racial groups. So out of Utah's general population, 16% of American Indian adults and 27% of children experience IGP. And you can compare this to the white population, which had just 2% of their adults and 2% of children experiencing IGP. This disparity can also be seen geographically, with San Juan County has the most tribal members and the highest incidences of IGP out of any county. When we were looking at national studies, we found that more employment opportunities were the most significant factor to poverty reduction for American Indians. Next slide. As for ethnicity, we found that 1 in 4 young adults ages 18 through 20 who are experiencing IGP are of Hispanic descent, and this is overrepresented at 24% relative to the state's Hispanic young adult population of 18%. When looking at national studies about poverty reduction for Hispanic young adults, we found that they were entering the workforce. They were less than half as likely as white young adults to have a post-secondary education. If they had one, though, it could increase their income. So Hispanic head of households with a post-secondary education, they earn twice the income and have 4 times the net worth than those without one. So that might be a factor that would help all young adults, but especially for Hispanics. Next slide. Along the same lines of education and employment, we found that 68% of IGP adults lack an education beyond high school, and only 1 in 3 IGP adults had year-round employment. And this isn't surprising, since educational attainment has a strong correlation with employment and income for individuals in general. There was a national study done that showed that the higher an individual's education level, the lower their participation in public assistance. You'll see the chart here. We compare the education level of an IGP adult on the right, on the left, and the general population on the right. The top green bar are those with less than high school education. The second bar are those with the high school level education. So you can see how that makes a huge amount compared to the general population. We do have about 8% of IGP adults who have a college degree. It's important to note we do have 23% that are unknown. That's because this is self-reported data. So a person might not have answered this question when they enrolled in one of our programs. So we see a very large difference in education and employment. This is a trend that has been common year after year. COVID-19 did disrupt some of the employment trends, which we'll go over a little later. Next slide. We also looked at age. So children up to age 10 have the highest rates of IGP compared to other youth. For adults, IGP was found mostly in younger age groups, in their 20s or 30s. This is to be expected. We tend to have younger parents with young children enrolling in public assistance programs when they need the most help. Our cohort also does not go any higher than 50 years old because of a lack of historical data. So keep that in mind, too. Next slide. Okay, so lastly, for the demographics section, we looked at household composition. 71% of IGP adults are parents of children in the household. This means we do have a lot of families who are experiencing IGP. 62% of IGP children are raised in single-parent households. And this is 3 times higher relative to our general population here in Utah. Next slide. All right, so moving on to the areas of child well-being section. Annually, Utah tracks 4 different areas that influence the progress of those experiencing IGP, and these were selected many years ago. We track them each year. So this includes early childhood development, education, family economic stability, and health. Next slide. So the report provides a lot of updates on many different data indicators. Because of our short time today, I just pulled some of the main changes here. So some positive annual changes included an increase in participation in enhanced kindergarten, increase in public health insurance coverage, a decrease in IGP adults who had to expend more than 30% of their income on housing, minimal to no annual changes, kindergarten readiness slightly decreased, high school graduation rate slightly increased. I'll go over those in the next slides. Moving more than once slightly increased. That suggests some family instability, possibly. Negative annual changes. We saw that behavioral health services and dental visits for children decrease. This could be that schools were closed and children couldn't access those behavioral health services. Parents could have chosen not to take their kids to the dentist to reduce the risk of COVID exposure. So those are to be expected. Year-round employment also decreased. Next slide. So I did pull 4 different charts from this section to share with you today. This first one's from early childhood education. Kindergarten readiness was found to remain low, and it did slightly drop from 2019. Here you'll see the entry exams for KEEP. And these are the rates of students who achieved the highest level on their entry exam. So IGP children, they had 34% score the highest in literacy and 55% score numeracy. These are both lower than the average Utah student as well as non-IGP students. Those are students in situational poverty. So as you see, there's still room for improvement here. Next slide. The second highlight is from education. We found that graduation rates from high school continue to increase. You can see since 2012, when the IGP initiative first started, that it has increased quite a bit over the years. It was at 50% back then and is now at 79%. So that's a great achievement. However, it still remains lower than the average student, but we are getting closer each year, which is promising. Next slide. The third highlight is from family economic stability. So this is a visual of employment rates by gender and IGP and non-IGP. So in the rows, you'll see IGP males are in the top row. The second row is IGP females, followed by non-IGP. The columns show the rate of those groups in their employment status from no employment to working 1 to 3 quarters and employed full year. So you'll see that IGP females in the second row on the far right had the most year-round employment at 30%, compared to men, which were at 23%. As for no employment on the far left, we had more IGP males at 45% compared to IGP females at 40%. So this is a trend that occurred in 2019 as well. So this isn't new for 2020, but still interesting to look at. Next slide. The final highlight from the areas of child well-being is from health. We found that treatment for substance use increased, and it has been increasing over time, but especially in 2020. This graph breaks it down by age groups in the horizontal lines, and the three dots go from 2018 to 2019 to 2020. And you'll see there has been increases in all age groups over the years. This could be a positive or a negative finding. It's positive if more people who need the treatment are seeking it and getting help. It could be negative if we are seeing more people turning to the substance use, especially maybe with the stress of the pandemic, and therefore we have more people seeking help. We also had Medicaid expansion, brought in more adults. It's possible that they had higher needs for substance use treatment than previous cohorts. So there are some possibilities there. More research would need to be conducted to determine that further. Okay, next slide. All right, so let's talk about COVID-19 and how it impacted IGP individuals. First, I'd like to thank our research partners, which you'll hear from later on. They took the extra work to help pull together these new data indicators for us. So first, we looked at domestic violence. Since there have been a rise in cases in the general public due to the lockdown, we found that 25% of child protective service cases for IGP children had domestic violence-related child abuse. This means a child witnessed domestic violence. This was a little higher rate than the previous year. It's possible that it was underreported because kids weren't in school and witnesses couldn't report abuse. So in theory, it could have been higher. We also looked at internet access and the digital divide. San Juan, Paiute, and Wayne counties had the most households without broadband internet, and they had the highest rates of children at risk of becoming IGP adults. We know that USBE has invested a lot into internet access the past year, especially in San Juan County, so we will most likely see positive returns from that in the IGP population. We also analyzed returning students enrollment. We found that 6% of missing students were IGP children who were expected to return in the 2020-21 school year, but did not. This suggests that those students may have had more major disruptions in their learning compared to others. And then we also looked at COVID-19 health indicators. And this one's really interesting. So we found that the IGP population experienced slightly higher COVID-19 positive case rates than the general public, yet they experienced lower hospitalizations, lower deaths, and lower case fatality rates. So that was good news. I think the IGP population may have had higher exposure to COVID if, say, they still had their job and they couldn't work from home or they had to take public transit. This is aligned with what other national studies are saying. The low hospitalization and deaths may be because our IGP population is young. It only goes up to age 50. And it was mostly older people who were affected by COVID in 2020.
I just have to mention something. So this comparison was across all the Utah population, but IGP cutoff is at the age of 50 years. So when we, so recently I compared them by the cutoff of age 50 years for the Utah population, and it's showing higher incidence, higher hospitalization, and higher death rates if we cut it off at the 50 years, because IGP and non-IGP cohort stops at 50 years of age. That is our limitation.
Gotcha. Thanks for clarifying that. And Shree is from the Utah Department of Health, and she did a very detailed analysis on this. So she'll be presenting more of those results later today. So I won't say any more on that. All right, next slide. We also looked at different learning delivery models during the pandemic, and we found that hybrid learning was common for schools with high IGP populations. So this is where the school has 10% or more who are IGP. Hybrid was also the most common for low IGP schools. The main difference we saw is when we looked at virtual learning, high IGP schools had a rate that was 3 times higher than low IGP schools for virtual learning during the pandemic. So our report made a recommendation to keep tracking this in the future, see if there are any correlations between a learning delivery model and a student's future test scores. Next slide. Okay, so this was a big finding, looking at job loss during the pandemic. These are the unemployment trends by IGP adult on the left, non-IGP in the middle, and the general labor force on the right. You'll see that IGP adults experience job loss at a rate more than twice as high as the general labor force. So we're looking at 38% versus 16%. Non-IGP adults actually have the highest rate of job loss. This isn't surprising since non-IGP measures situational poverty such as job loss. So it makes sense that we see a lot in the non-IGP cohort. And when we measured this, we looked at only at IGP adults who were employed in the first quarter of 2020 and tracked if they filed at least one unemployment claim for the year. Next slide. So IGP adults experienced higher job loss, but we found that their monthly income actually increased. So we measure income through what's reported through SNAP, so an IGP SNAP recipient, and it nearly doubled from $1,100 to just over $2,000 from 2019 to 2020. So that was surprising to us at first, but when we looked into the policies that took place, we see that regular and federal pandemic unemployment benefits may have boosted their reported income. Stimulus checks were never counted as income for SNAP, but they most likely helped too. So we see that these additional benefits may have helped IGP families weather the pandemic. Okay, next slide. So what policies helped IGP families in 2020? We saw that public assistance policies extended eligibility, such as for Medicaid, or they increased benefit payments, such as through SNAP. Childcare co-payments were waived for households as well. And then, like I said, the pandemic and regular unemployment benefits, they all helped IGP families stay afloat. Also, Medicaid expansion, that was not a COVID-19 policy, but it happened in 2020. It helped more than 16,000 IGP adults receive health insurance coverage during the pandemic. So that was good timing there. So overall, it seems like families seem to be doing okay in 2020, but there could still be longer lasting impacts on their children's academic achievement, their overall economic success, and long-term health. Okay, next slide. The report also looks at different promising practices, including the trauma-informed center that you heard about today. We also looked at policies already in the works that may help IGP families. So in 2020, this includes the plan to consolidate DHS and DOH to align services that will help IGP families streamlining those services. Number two, the legislature provided grants for adults who have not completed their post-secondary certificate or degree to help them come back to school. Third, the legislature also provided post-secondary education opportunities for incarcerated youth. And over 20% of IGP youth are part of the juvenile justice system, so this could really help them out. And then finally, the federal child tax credit has increased payment for families, and also one-third of the nation's poorest children will now qualify for the child tax credit, which will most likely include some of our IGP children. Next slide. So in conclusion, through this data, Utah can continue focusing on ensuring low-income families don't fall behind as unemployment and other COVID-19 benefits end. With the help of COVID-19 relief funds, we know the city has already taken the initiative to fill service gaps and addressing pressing needs for all Utahns, which will also help IGQ families. As the state and local governments, private, nonprofit, and faith-based organizations work together, our work will continue to helping Utahns who are experiencing IGP and ensuring that they have an equitable opportunity to reach their full potential. Next slide. So here's my contact information. If you need any additional info about IGP, you can find the report and data at intergenerationalpoverty.utah.gov later today. So that's all I have. Thank you for your time. I'll turn it back over to Casey.
Thanks, Brittany. I want to give the commission and committee members an opportunity to ask any questions. We're really excited about this year's report. Brittany was very thoughtful in her approach and I think very thorough as well. So I'll open it up for any questions or comments to Brittany.
Looks like Ben has a question.
Yeah, this is so well done. Thank you so much. You know, your finding about knowing the background of IGP regarding their education levels, I think it was like 23% unknown because of how it's reported. Makes me wonder if there's ever an occasion to create like a policy recommendation sheet or something for the kinds of questions that need improvements or data collection items that need to be improved to enhance what we know about the population. I mean, that could just be one example, but I know that some agencies, this could be old information, you know, have a lot of missing data on race because it's voluntarily reported. Do you have opinions about kind of what agencies could do better to collect the kind of information that would create a little more certainty about the population?
Oh, I like your idea of looking at what data, all the, 'cause we collect so much data every year, and there are a few holes here and there. I think that's a good idea to create a list of here's what we could improve. I think it's up to the commission if they want to make that a policy of improving it or looking into it.
There could be reasonable reasons why it's missing, but there could be other uses of data that agencies don't really realize are important for reports such as this. So I acknowledge I don't really know the limitations of agencies, but it strikes me that could be an important component of recommendations going forward.
Neil?
Neil, are you able to unmute? We see that your hand's up.
There we go. Is that better? Can you hear me
now? Yes, it is. Thank you.
Okay. Sorry. Double muted. I think we all know how that goes. Anyway, great job, Brittany, and I just mentioned I really liked Dr. Gibbs' suggestion as well. The piece of data that really got my attention was the high school graduation that I think went from 50% up substantially to 70-something or maybe 80. What happened there? I mean, that did we change the definition or was it something that, was there an intervention? That's remarkable. I'm just trying to understand that a little better.
I think this was a question that came up last year as well. I don't know if USBE is here and can speak to it.
I'm a tutor. I work at the USBE data statistics. I don't have anything to offer about that. Be happy to come back with some answers, though.
Yeah, I don't think we know if there were any specific interventions that led to that. I think I've heard Sydney Dixon say in the past that she does believe that the work of this commission has helped with that. Maybe not directly, but some other indirect programs or interventions they've done in general that might have contributed to the graduation rate.
Yeah, it's so interesting to me. I mean, as a pediatrician, that is strongly correlated with health outcomes throughout life too, right? That high school graduation rate. I'm so intrigued by that. If that was something that the committee did that led to that, that'd be kind of, I mean, I'd really like to know what that is. So anyway, thank you.
Hey, Tracy has a comment.
Yeah, just maybe a little bit of historic context. I mean, there's no question that when the governor, I see Patty Norman's on the call. She would be the much better person, so I'll defer to her.
So you can finish that conversation if you want, but I was just going to speak about how it's actually one of the measures in Education Elevated and making sure that every student is known, whereas before it used to be that we had this compilation of all students together, but then making sure each student is known by a caring adult in the building, and then focusing on those outcomes not only at the state level, but then at the local level as well, and then responding to those in different ways. And so whereas before it was just a part of a larger data set, then breaking that data set down to the student level has really what's shown the greatest outcome.
Thanks, Patty. Are there any other questions or comments? Insights?
Sorry, this is Nubia Pena. Good morning, and thank you so much, Brittany. Amazing job on this report. I was just wondering, in terms of our partnerships with USHE and the Systems of Higher Education, you know, they recently launched their Work and Learn program for apprenticeship and being able to build the capacity for individuals to have a trade or to have some type of work experience that, you know, they're coming out at $15 to $20 an hour. We know that pay, you know, the pay for some of these families would be significant if they're able to engage in employment opportunities that could get them out of living paycheck to paycheck. And I'm just wondering if, you know, part of the recommendations is to work more closely with some of the organizations that are leading out on these opportunities. I'm just thinking about, like, how do we fix this, right? Like, so the report is giving us some really key indicators, but we've got all of this money that's coming in from ARPA. Like, how do we best tackle this issue to make sure that, you know, as USHE is developing their programs, they are looking to your data points. As, you know, some of our partners in different departments are looking to their initiatives, they are looking to address this. Like, how do we make sure that there is an interconnected engagement opportunity here from multiple sectors in government as well as public-private partnership where we are tackling IGT?
That's a good question that I'll let the commission and advisory committee answer. You know, I guess you're kind of asking what are the next steps and how to make sure that the right stakeholders are getting this information.
Yeah, Nubia, thank you for joining and thank you for that question. We did have a robust discussion with the Lieutenant Governor, although she wasn't able to join today. We briefed her on this report and also the prep for this meeting. And we do have some ideas on how we can move this work forward. It is a 10-year anniversary, as was brought up earlier. We're super excited about this report, and also the larger context, as we've talked about, that there's a lot of communities, a lot of organizations, and then just the robust research that we're seeing with the research subcommittee. There's a lot of work being done in each of the agencies, and so I've talked with both the chief, the lieutenant governor, Tracy, and I have chatted about this. And we have some ideas on how to operationalize this a little bit more so that we move this work more into this is just how we do business and not so much of an initiative. And I think that that's what people are kind of craving and what we're seeing with the data and all of the work that's been done is to continue the data research, to continue looking at these policies. But to your point, Nubia, how are we connecting this on an operational level with the work that we're doing every day in our agencies? And I think that's the point we're at. And we'd like to propose some ideas, maybe adjust some of the legislation, and really see, especially with the merger that's taking place between health and human services, how that work can move forward. So I don't know, Tracy, if you want to add to that, but I know that this is a lot on your mind as you're developing your new structure.
Yeah, it is. I mean, in the right now, the focus in bringing the two entities together requires a pretty heavy lift just legally and with code changes, but absolutely. I mean, even with this year's report, across our teams, making sure that our leadership is aware of it and that it's front and center as we're bringing our two departments together to start addressing some of that. So, yeah, I mean, I agree. It should be part of our practice that we are aware of not only individuals experiencing intergenerational poverty, but other populations that we need to be aware of that might be either disproportionately represented in some of our programs, and that has to be part of our practice, in my opinion, and will be within the new department.
Casey, thank you so much. Tracy, thank you so very much. And I am just wondering, like, if it's appropriate, for us to start to potentially put you all in front of a couple of our stakeholders, because again, when I'm thinking about public-private partnerships and folks who are interested in addressing their labor shortage and addressing some of their opportunities within their community and social impact investment, that they look to your data points, right? We've been using the Kempsey-Gardner race, ethnicity, and sex data report to help understand the inequities that are happening in housing, healthcare, education, and economy. But this is one other data point that we can look to understand that there are additional factors that need to be considered and that it's complex and interconnected. And so using these data sets to inform our process of where we can drive opportunity and make sure that we are inspired really to make sure we're helping the people in the state. So just again, I'm already thinking about a couple of places that I think it'd be good for folks to understand not only the work of this group, but then also how they can use the report, especially celebrating 10 years in the work that you've been doing to help inform their efforts. So, with your permission, I'd like to put you all in front of some folks. Casey, is that a yes? A no? A maybe?
Nubia, you know what? We will partner with you in any way you want us to. So, you absolutely have our permission. So, and that can be, there's going to be more reports we're going to hear about, and we're running short on time, so I do want to move on to those so that we give everyone time, but you'll probably want several of these individuals to come in and present, maybe if that's what you're looking for.
Yes, absolutely, and thank you so much, Casey. I appreciate that. Thank you.
Okay, thanks, Brittany. Well done.
Casey, can I have one more question?
Sure,
Brittany, can you go back to the slide on internet and connectivity? Because this is something that we've been really kind of worried about. Which is the cliff that might occur, because right now we have ESSER funds, and being able to provide that internet access, the ability to work with, say, San Juan, and that connectivity for those who haven't had it. We've seen qualitatively, in speaking to the LEA, local education agency, how they've really seen an increase in the number of students having access, having greater outcomes because they're working together, and the families being engaged and learning new skills because they actually had a device and connectivity at home. I'm just looking at this and hoping that we remember that this great influx of money was for ESSER COVID-related funds, and without those funds, what will we do at the end of this time when families were counting on this infrastructure that was paid for, what will happen at that time. So just kind of maybe checking on those data points as we move forward.
Yeah, I think that's awesome. So I think the plan is for next year to see your broadband initiative and look at more outcomes that came from that. So we'll be in touch with that.
Great. Thanks for that question, Patty. Lots of kudos in the chat for you, Brittany, so make sure you see those. Let's move on to our research subcommittees. I think first up we're going to have Wynn from USBE, and I'll just point out we've got 20 minutes left on our meeting here, and so if we can keep each of the presentations to about 4 minutes, we should be good to go. And I'm sorry that it's brief, but hopefully we can share your research with this group. And if there's any other questions, we can certainly come back next time and address those. So Wynn is up, then we'll go to Suri Bose, Kelsey, and then Dustin in that order.
Thank you. Thanks for that. Thanks, Brittany. Great job. Thanks, everyone, for the opportunity to share the recent study that we did examining school discipline experiences of students affected by intergenerational poverty. I want to start by acknowledging the other members of this team. I certainly didn't do this alone. David Mackey, Malia McKelvin, Dr. Jimmy Hernandez, David Christensen also put a great deal of work into this. Thanks for that. Next slide, please. So our purpose for this study was to determine the extent to which students affected by intergenerational poverty received infractions, so that's school incidents, and experienced exclusionary disciplines relative to other student groups. So just a few things to point out there. I'm going to show you a lot of comparisons across different student groups, and also this idea of exclusionary disciplines. We operationalized that as in-school and out-of-school suspensions that were a half day or greater, and also expulsions. Next slide, please. To do that, we used four primary data sources. We matched the list of students that we received from the Department of Workforce Services with the Utah State Board of Education's enrollment table, and also the incident and discipline data. And then we also created a matched comparison group, which I'll tell you a little bit more about in just a moment. I'm not going to have time today to go through all the research questions and their answers, so I'll show you just a few metrics, and I'll associate those with each of the research questions and show you what we found. That first two, incident rate and discipline rate, we'll talk about together. That's the count of incidents and the count of disciplines within each student group divided by the enrollment count of each student group. Lost days is the count of lost days of instruction divided by the enrollment count times 100. And then finally, we calculated a logistic regression analysis that predicted the likelihood that students would receive an exclusionary discipline based on poverty status and mapped covariates. Next slide. So three results slide here. This first one's answering the question, which student groups had the highest incidence and discipline rates, incident and discipline rates. You can see the same groups represented on both sides there, led by Native American students, students affected by intergenerational poverty, Black students, special education, low income, and so on. Next slide, please. So here we're trying to understand the extent to which some student groups are missing more days due to exclusionary disciplines than others. This graphic is showing the number of lost days of instruction per 100 students. Again, you can see Native American, Black, and intergenerational poverty and special ed leading in terms of having the most lost days of instruction due to exclusionary disciplines per 100 students. Next slide, please. So here we're trying to understand the likelihood that students affected by intergenerational poverty would receive a discipline. In this case, we used a matched comparison group. This group was matched on things like school year, school, gender, race, ethnicity, English learner status, special ed, those types of things. And we predicted the outcome of whether or not students would receive a discipline based on their membership as a member of the IGP cohort or this matched comparison group. And from that, we learned that students affected by intergenerational poverty were nearly two times more likely than similar peers to receive a discipline. Next slide, please. I should point out as we transition into this next slide, I don't know if you called that R-square just underneath that table there, but we're definitely explaining very little of the variance. And that's important to note as a limitation. There's a lot of other things besides membership in this group that are predicting this outcome of whether or not students received the discipline. Thanks. So it's interesting that previous studies have found no evidence that certain student groups misbehave with greater frequency than others do. However, as you just saw in these results, some groups of students are experiencing school incidents and disciplines very differently than others are. In particular, Native American students, Black students, students affected by IGP, low-income students, and special education students are particularly impacted. Next slide. I'll leave you with just a few policy considerations. Unfortunately, we don't have a lot of time to get into this particular piece, but alternative approaches to student discipline are certainly worth considering, things like relationship building, restorative justice, social and emotional learning, and structural interventions like positive behavioral interventions and supports. We think that the metrics we're putting forward could be used at the ALEA or even the school level to identify potential disparities and work to address those disparities. And as those things are uncovered at the ALEA school level, investing in training for teachers, administrators, and school resource officers could be really beneficial. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, let's move on to Department of Health.
Hi, I'm Shri Bose, and we worked on the intergenerational poverty and COVID-19 in Utah for the 2020 year, and I was helped by Ghazali, Navina, and Brian for this report. Next slide, please. So the background is, as we all know, that the COVID has disproportionately impacted the most impoverished population, and it is very well established that the county and zip codes has shown association of COVID-19 incidents, morbidity and mortality rates in the most disadvantageous neighborhoods. However, the research hasn't been done in Utah regarding the intergenerational poverty cohort and the severity of COVID-19 among this population. Next slide, please. So the objective is to explore the disparity of COVID-19 incidence, hospitalization, and mortality among the population of IGP and the non-IGP cohort, and also identify the total hospital utilization by seeing what was the total charges of COVID-19 hospitalization among the IGP and non-IGP cohort. Next slide, please. So the data is from the DWS. We got the data for the intergenerational poverty and non-intergenerational poverty, but and the only limitation over there is they only have a population till the age of less than equal to 50 years. This was merged with the socioeconomic, demographic, healthcare, hospitalization, total charges data from the EpiTrax and from the Utah Health Facility Database from the Department of Health for 2020. Next slide, please. So we have only performed descriptive statistics because for the hospitalization incidence and mortality and the total charges, because the IGP and non-IGP cohort is a little bit similar in the sense of using public assistance. It's only the degree of assistance that they are using. So that's why I didn't think that we should be comparing. And the Utah population data was only at the aggregate level, so I couldn't compare them to create significant differences. And the analysis was performed in a SAS software. Next slide, please. So the finding is the IGP cohort had, as you can see, the unique observation was, and out of which 48.84% of the population was less than 18 years, and 55% of the population were female. So the population of female for both IGP and non-IGP cohort is higher than the general Utah population. So that was a standout that we saw. And as you can see, Salt Lake, Utah, Weber, and Davis comprised of most of the population for the IGP and non-IGP cohort. Next slide, please. So across the U.S. for the entire population, 6.16% were COVID-19 positive rate. And for Utah population, it was 8.61% positive rate. But if you just cut it off at the age of 50 years, the Utah population COVID rate was 8.89%. Compared to that, for both IGP and non-IGP cohort, it's still higher because IGP had a 9.64% COVID rate and non-IGP cohort had 10.15%. So both of them are much higher compared to the Utah all population as well as restricted to the age of 50 years. The groups that had a higher positive cases, such as the female, Black, Pacific Islanders, Hispanics, and American Indians, had a higher positive rate compared to the general population of all age groups, as well as if you limit it to the age group of 54. Next slide, please. For COVID-19 hospitalization, as you can see at the national level, it was 0.28% for the entire all age groups, and for the state level, it was 0.36% hospitalization rate and a 4.17% among all COVID positive rates. Compared to that, that was for the entire general population. If you limit it to the 50 age group, the Utah hospitalization rate was 0.2%, and the hospitalization rate among COVID positive cases was 2.1%. So both the IGP group and non-IGP group, as you can see, had a higher rate compared to the age group cutoff of Utah population. But comparing to the entire Utah, it shows lower. So there is a disparity right there. You can see the differences. The demographic statistics were same for both Utah all population as well as limiting it to the age of 50 years. Female American Indians, Black, African American, Hispanics never married, and those receiving Medicaid had the highest rates of COVID-19 comparing it to the general population. Next slide, please. The mortality rate was, as you can see, compared to the U.S. and Utah all population, it was lower for the IGP group and non-IGP group, but if you limit it to the 50 years, they were actually much higher. But the demographic statistics still holds for both the general population as well as for the age limit of 50 years. Females and American Indians had a higher fatality rate compared to the general population. Next slide, please. So the total charges on average for the Utah was $62,300, and compared to that, IGP was $43,516 and non-IGP was $48,287. So they were a little bit lower than compared to the entire Utah population. So as you can see, Native Hawaiians, females, and married population had the highest average hospitalization charges for COVID-19 among IGP. Next slide, please. So this is just a summary of all the findings. Sorry, I think you went back. Okay. And just the discussion is we saw a high proportion of females in the IGP cohort, and the American Indian, African, Native Hawaiians, Black had a higher COVID positive rates among the IGP and non-IGP cohort compared to the Utah population. Some of the risk factors are underlying health condition, uninsurance, vulnerable housing situations. They cannot isolate themselves from other people, working in jobs that they cannot be doing telework, and requiring to use of public transportation. Those might be putting them in more risk than the other people who are not in this cohort. Next slide, please. So similar to the same situation as the African-American, American Indian, Alaska Natives, and Pacific Islanders face a similar kind of situations. Next slide, please. And so the policy implications we can only see is like reducing better employment opportunities, giving them paid sick leave, safe housing, quality healthcare services, healthy food, and subsidized internet services might be able to have an impact on reducing the incidence, hospitalization, and mortality rate among these cohorts. Thank you. I think that's all I have. Sorry I was running through it.
Thank you so much. Let's hear from USBE, Kelsey.
I'm Kelsey from Workforce Services. I'm just going to run through, point you guys to the really main findings in the sake of time. So we want to understand the impacts, the workforce impacts of COVID-19 on those experiencing intergenerational poverty. So for our research, we compared the 2019 cohorts of IGP adults to those experiencing situational poverty, and we looked specifically at the wage record and workforce attachment, so that's the number of quarters worked in 2019 and 2020. So we really were trying to understand the changes in wages from 2019 through 2020 for these adults. Next slide, please. So the median wages for both groups stayed pretty constant. However, I do want to point out that about 67% of adults that we looked at, so those in situational poverty and those experiencing IGP, had wage loss from 2019 to first quarter of 2021. And we did find that men and older adults were significantly more likely to experience wage loss during this time. Next slide, please. So just for workforce attachment, kind of skimming to the main stuff here, again, for one-third of adults experienced a reduction in workforce attachment in our study, so that was number of quarters worked annually each year. We did find certain demographic groups were more likely to experience declines in workforce attachment, specifically those identifying as African-American, American Indian. And I want to point out that we did see that those with a college degree actually experienced a statistically significant increase in workforce attachment from 2019 to 2020, so really highlighting again the importance of post-secondary education in buffering economic impacts of recession. Next slide, please. So just to kind of sum that all up, I didn't find any statistically significant differences between the IGP group and the situational poverty group, but we did see a really large percentage of all the adults in the study experiencing wage loss during the COVID-19 recession, and about 31% of all adults in the study experienced a reduction in workforce attachment from 2019 to 2020. Again, pointing out that post-secondary education and college is really important in keeping people employed in the workforce. And I think the reason we didn't find any difference between these two groups was that they are demographically similar, and that's by design, but in this case, they were just too similar. So just highlighting that those in situational poverty and those experiencing IGPs did experience large workforce impacts during the COVID-19 recession. And I'll hand it over to Dustin.
Hello, everyone. Our research pertains to the service involvement of children experiencing IGP. If more is understood about this group, then interventions and programs can be targeted to those who need the most and the success of those measures evaluated. Next slide, please. I'm going to go ahead and skip this. We have the same experimental and control group. We're comparing IGP kids to a situational poverty group. We matched service records between four divisions within the Department of Human Services and constructed various variables around that data. Next slide, please. I'm going to go ahead and skip this statistical measure, and suffice to say that the findings that I'm presenting are statistically significant. Next slide, please. The children experiencing intergenerational poverty matched at far higher rates for three of the divisions that were participating in the study. You'll see in particular for DCFS, it's more than twice the match rate. This is the percent of clients who had any service with the participating division. The only one that we saw a higher rate for the comparison kids group was for DSPD. All of these are statistically significant. Next slide, please. IGP children were also far more likely to have received services from two or from three divisions, suggesting deeper needs among these groups. Next slide, please. So this Venn diagram depicts the intersections of all four divisions and indicates whether the IGP or the comparison group were served at higher rates, these intersections mean combinations of division services, and whether that was statistically significant. So at all intersections not featuring DSPD, there was a statistically significant higher service receipt rate among the IGP group. For DSPD, there was a statistically significant higher service rate at all intersections that don't feature DCFS, and for the others featuring DSPD and DCFS, there was no statistically significant difference between the two cohorts. Next slide, please. So in a nutshell, IGP children or children experiencing IGP entered services a little younger on average, but a year and a half earlier. They're disproportionately likely to have ended services via the child welfare system, and the types of services they received early in that child welfare service system suggests that they may be more likely to enter the system via court-ordered home-based services or foster removal, which suggests disproportionate child protective services involvement. Next slide, please. So, in a nutshell, children experiencing IGP demonstrate broader service needs and demonstrate them earlier. This is based on match rates and the prevalence of these services among two or by three divisions. These findings persist when controlling for age. I should note that a higher or lower rate matching with divisions, it does not suggest anything inherently positive or negative. It's much like the substance abuse data that was discussed earlier. We don't know how many children who might need services are not being treated. So a positive rate among IGP could mean that we are, or a higher rate could indicate that we are addressing these children's needs earlier and hopefully more thoroughly. We suggest ways of identifying clients experiencing IGP in early in the service process to target the interventions and services that they may need earlier, and also targeted research to develop and evaluate the success of interventions and service packages on these clients to demonstrate their success. Hopefully similar research will have been done in other states or within Utah via pilot programs, and we can evaluate the success of those measures by linking them to workforce services receipts for public assistance. So that's it for me.
Okay, thank you. And you wrapped up just on time there. And I apologize, Kelsey, I was reading my notes here, but I absolutely know you work for DWS, so that's what I get from reading my notes. Do we have any other business from the committee or the commission that we need to entertain at this time? I'm sorry we don't have time for Q&A on the research reports. They're great. I'm assuming those are going to be posted online as well. Will we link to those from the IGP website? Okay, great. So if you want to dive into those, thank you for all of that hard work. And I know the research subcommittee, you guys have really taken off from where we started. You know, I could say 7-8 years ago, you guys have really taken off. So it's just awesome. Once again, do we have any other business or public comments that we need to entertain at this time?
Stacey, I have a question. It's Tracy. Just in terms of the report going out, I think you mentioned that it's being released publicly today. If there's anything that we can do as part of the commission to help elevate that, if there's a packet, social media related, just let us know and we'll make sure that we take care of that.
I think there is, and I'll double check with Christina on that. They put together social media packets that can kind of be spread around, so I'll have her send those over to your comms folks.
Thank you. That's perfect. I'll let her know.
Okay, great. And since we have a quorum, can we really quick get a motion to approve the minutes so that we take care of that back on the first part of the agenda? Those minutes are from April 14th. Do I have any a motion to approve those minutes?
So moved.
Okay, thank you. Do we have a second to that?
Second.
Okay, thank you. Well, we'll move forward with an approval of those minutes. Everyone in favor say aye.
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 Those minutes have been approved. Okay, and I don't think we have an upcoming meeting scheduled yet, Rebecca, do we?
We do. It is the next meeting. Sorry, it's on the bottom of your agenda. For the commission meeting, December 14th, and for the advisory, November 30th.
Okay. We just have some outstanding issues with an advisory board chair. And so those are issues that we continue to work through with the lieutenant governor and the governor's office, and so we'll keep working on those and let you know. But thank you so much, everyone, and look forward to news going around social media, to Tracy's point, to promote that and elevate that, and the good work of the research that's been done this year. We appreciate everybody's good work. And we will stand adjourned. Can we get a motion to adjourn this meeting unless anybody wants to stand longer? Tracy, you got your hand up. Sorry, I just saw that. Tracy?
Adjourn. Motion to adjourn.
Okay.
I think that was my old hand, but yeah.
That was your old hand? Okay.
Yeah. Bye. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Bye-bye.